Lecture 9, Mencius and Xunzi, Confucius's successors.
Hi, welcome back. In this lecture, we're going to talk about Mencius and Xunzi, who were two of the great successors to Confucius. Now, that second name is a little tricky. Xunzi is X-U-N-Z-I. The X makes a sort of an S-H sound, Xunzi. Both Mencius and Xunzi accepted the main precepts of Confucianism, but they disagreed on several issues, including, most memorably, whether human nature was basically good or basically bad. Mencius's ideas, and he takes the more optimistic of those two positions, he eventually became dominant in the Confucian tradition. So it's a quick way to tell them apart, right? Mencius thinks that human nature is good, Xunzi thinks that it's bad. But there's more to their thought than this one idea, as important as that may be. We'll start with Mencius. He lived from about 372 to 289 BC. So he's a contemporary with Aristotle. And he lives during the time of the 100 schools of philosophy, which we talked about earlier. Mencius's life was in many ways parallel to that of Confucius. He was actually born only about 50 miles from where Confucius was born. Mencius also lost his father at a young age. He was raised by a single mother. He devoted himself to scholarship, but times were even worse. Remember, this is the Warring States era now. And so Mencius traveled for about 40 years seeking government employment. One story from those years is he had an interview with a king who was hoping that he could give him advice for military conquest. And Mencius replied that gaining the empire through violence was a little bit like climbing a tree in order to look for fish. It's just not going to happen that way. Okay. And he didn't get that job, of course. Mencius served briefly as an official, but he was, again like Confucius, mostly a teacher. And he himself had been taught by students of Confucius's grandson. So there's kind of a direct, there's a lineal connection there. Mencius, as I said, was raised by a single mother. And in this course, we can use all the women that we can find. So let me talk about Mencius's mother for a little bit. She's oftentimes thought of as a role model to Chinese mothers today. So the story is that she was trying to find a place for her and her son, her young son, to live. And she found a place next to a cemetery. And then when her son would be playing, he would wail and he would pretend that he was a professional mourner there. And she said, this isn't quite the environment that I want for my son. So she moved, and she moved to a marketplace. And the next thing she knew, little Mencius was playing, buying and selling and arranging goods as if he were a shopkeeper. And she said, that's not exactly what I want either for my son. And so she moved a third time to a home next to a school. And then Mencius would play school, teacher and student, and he would pretend to read books. She said, this is the right sort of place for my son to grow up. So she was invested in his education, and that continued. There's a story once that he came home from school, and she said, so what did you learn today? And Mencius said, same as usual. And his mother, who was actually weaving at the time, something that women in Chinese homes often did, she took a knife and she slashed through the cloth that was on the loom. And her son was quite shocked by that, said, what are you doing? And she said, if you neglect your studies, if you're not taking them seriously, it's the same as me cutting cloth from the loom. Unless I weave, who is going to take care of me? And unless you study, you're going to be dependent on others. In fact, unless you get more serious about your studies, you're going to end up a servant or a thief. And Mencius was taken aback by that and vowed to study even harder. One more story from his mother. When Mencius was older and was married, he once walked into his bedroom door and his wife was there, not completely dressed, which is a sort of breach of etiquette. Remember how important ritual is for Confucian scholars. And so he left without saying anything, but he was a bit put off by that. His wife noticed that he had started treating her as a stranger. And so she went to her mother-in-law. They're living with the mother. And she said, why don't you just send me back home to my family? Because this marriage isn't working out so well. And the mother, Mencius's mother, went to talk to her son and said, it was impolite to barge in on people. Like next time, before you enter a room, why don't you make a little noise? Like you could knock or you could say something. But because you haven't behaved properly, then you blame other people. You blame your wife for not being appropriately having the right sort of etiquette. Don't blame other people. Okay, Mencius, of course, took his mother's words to heart, became a great moralist as well. I guess the moral of these three stories is behind every great man in China is a mother. Once again, with Mencius, there's a man and there's a book. You know, so the man's name is Mencius and the book's name is The Mencius. It's a record of his conversations, but unlike the Analects, Mencius's text offers extended arguments where he debates back and forth with his philosophical opponents, including the followers of Mozi. Remember the philosopher who talked about universal love or impartial caring. Mencius says that Mozi is wrong because morality should come from principle, not from self-interest or from utility. Remember that Mozi said, if it doesn't contribute to food and clothing and shelter, then it just doesn't matter. And Mencius said, no, there are things that matter by principle. He also says, this is Mencius now, he's saying, you can't love another person's family as much as you love your own. Then he's going to argue with the followers of Yang Zhu and say, it's wrong to assert that self and pleasure are more important than duty and service. So Yang Zhu is wrong because he's too much on the selfish side, and Mozi is wrong as well because it's too unrealistically generous. Both of those are wrong because they deny human nature. Mencius wants his morality to be grounded in human nature, which is the subject of his most famous debate. And this is with Gaozi over whether people are naturally good or bad. Gaozi says, human nature is neither one. It's sort of like water, so that people can be made to do good things or bad things. It depends on, like water can be channeled one direction to the left or to the right. It just doesn't matter. And Mencius's reply was, well, people are actually naturally good. I like your analogy, but it's more like water goes downhill. Okay? And that's its natural tendency. Now, you can splash it up higher, you can keep it up with dams, but it does have a natural tendency. Okay, nice analogy, but what evidence would there be that people are naturally good? And Mencius gives a famous example. He says, imagine that there's a child, a toddler, who's walking along and then is about to fall into a well. Anyone who sees this situation will feel this momentary sense of panic, this sort of, as this happens. And he says, and it's not anything that's thought out or calculated. It's not that you gasp because you want to please the parents of the child or because you want to enhance your reputation for being a moral person. Or you say, I just hate it when kids fall into wells. They cry and they cry, ruins your whole day. It's nothing like that. It just comes perfectly naturally and spontaneously. Everyone has the beginnings of morality within them. And he says there are four beginnings. There's benevolence that's run, this sort of human-heartedness, and righteousness, propriety, which is li, ritual, and wisdom. And he says those are as natural as having four limbs, arms and legs, for everyone. Okay, when someone says that human nature is good, then it's fair to ask, why is there so much evil in the world then? And Mencius's answer is, people have good impulses, but those can atrophy if they're not acted upon, which is why education is so important in moral development. Mencius once said, the great man is one who does not lose his child's heart. So you want to feel those impulses and then nurture them and cultivate them. Natural goodness is instilled in humans by heaven, and every person has the potential to become a sage through moral cultivation, which involves both qi, which is vital energy, we'll talk more about that when we talk about Neo-Confucianism, and xin, which is one's heart, mind. In Chinese, there's just one word that means what we refer to as both heart and mind. Those go together. Mencius then offers some refinements to Confucius's political ideals. Confucius talked a little bit about the mandate of heaven. Okay, here's the idea, is that heaven gives its seal of approval to some sort of a political regime. As long as those rulers are taking care of the common people, are generous, are helping out, providing order. But when those rulers, or actually their descendants, become corrupt and oppressive, heaven will withdraw its seal of approval and give it to some other family. They'll lose that. And you'll know when heaven starts to withdraw its approval because there will be portents. There will be natural disasters like eclipses and floods and droughts. And so rulers need to pay attention to those kinds of things. I know that may sound a little bit superstitious, and perhaps it is. We know that eclipses and earthquakes don't have anything to do with the morality of the rulers, but some of it kind of makes sense. In Chinese history, the Yellow River oftentimes broke through the dikes that kept it in. I mean, sometimes in Chinese history, the bed of the river was actually many feet above the floodplain. So when the dikes broke through, it was just disastrous. And that was thought of as a portent from heaven. Of course, sometimes that happens because the people, the administrators who were in charge of the waterworks were siphoning off money and things weren't getting paid and there's corruption and so the dikes aren't being properly maintained. So there might actually be a connection between flooding on the Yellow River and poor government. It kind of makes sense. Now, Mencius takes this idea of the mandate of heaven, and he takes it a little further by talking about the other part of that, which is when heaven gives its seal of approval to another family, that new person or family is justified in rebellion. And I should mention, heaven is not a personal god that sees over things. In Confucian thought, it's kind of an impersonal moral force. All right. So the mandate of heaven is closely associated with the welfare of the common people. And I'm going to give an example from Mencius. This is from the founding of the Zhou dynasty. The last dynasty, the Shang dynasty, had a ruler named Zhou. Different character, different pronunciation, kind of confusing. But that last ruler was a very corrupt guy. He was cruel and oppressive and lost the mandate of heaven. And then in the fighting that came, he actually was killed in that. There is a king who was talking to Mencius, asking about that particular episode in history. And he asked, "May a minister then put his sovereign to death?" Now, notice what a politically loaded question this is. This is a king who's saying, is it ever appropriate for somebody else to kill a king? And Mencius said, "He who outrages the benevolence proper to his nature is called a robber. He who outrages righteousness is called a ruffian. The robber and the ruffian we call a mere fellow. I have heard of the punishment of the fellow Zhou," that's the last cruel king, "but I've not heard of putting a sovereign to death in his case." So he's saying that he sort of lost that kingly imprimatur, that seal of approval, and then, yeah, those kind of people can be killed. All right, this is dangerous stuff. The founder of the Ming Dynasty in China, this is in the early 1400s, so he's new into this empire, and he doesn't want to hear any justifications for other people rebelling against him. He disliked these ideas in Mencius, and he halted the sacrifices at Mencius's ancestral temple. And in fact, he tried to get rid of about a third of the book, the Mencius, all of those passages that touched on the right of rebellion. Okay. Some of the earliest economic analysis in Chinese history comes from Mencius as well. I mean, this is an important part of statecraft. There was a philosopher named Xuzi who suggested to Mencius in conversation that it would be beneficial if everything had a set price so that no one would take advantage of even a child who went to the marketplace, right? You send a kid with some money, he could just read the prices, give it, and he won't be at a disadvantage in negotiating these prices, haggling. Mencius replied that that didn't really make sense. If, for example, every shoe of the same size were sold at the same price, why would anyone work harder to make a better quality shoe, he said. He also encouraged trade, which is a little bit of a change from Confucius. Confucius once said that the superior man cares about doing what's right. The inferior man cares about making a profit. There's sort of a hesitancy about market values there. And Mencius thought that trade was important. He also thought the division of labor was something that could be a good part of a well-organized society. He came across a king who was proud that he farmed himself right alongside his subjects. And when he talked to him, though, he asked this king, "So you're growing your own grain, that's great, but where did you get your cap? where do you get the pots that you cook with, or the plows that you use? And the king says, well, I don't make those myself. I have to barter for those. Mencius says, why then would it be bad to barter for rulership, right? Some people might give food and clothing to a particular individual in return for good government, for administration. Mencius says, some people labor with their minds and others with their strength. And then finally, he encourages a well-field system as a way to ensure limited, sustainable taxation. Okay, that needs more explanation. The Chinese character for a well, it looks like a tic-tac-toe board, or like, or maybe like the pound sign. And the idea there is to divide up land in that shape and then have eight families all have land around the outside, and then there's one square in the middle. They all farm that together, and the produce from that middle square pays their taxes for everyone. So limited, sustainable taxation. Okay, that idea was talked about later on in Chinese history. It never really got off the ground. It was pretty hard to implement. But Mencius is thinking along these lines of practical administration. Now, don't get me wrong here. Mencius doesn't exactly celebrate capitalism. That would be pretty anachronistic. And indeed, the beginning of his book, The Mencius, starts with a famous story, and I'll paraphrase it for you. He went to see King Hui of the state of Liang. And the king said to Mencius, you've come all this distance, I'm several hundred miles. You surely must have something to profit my kingdom. Mencius said, why talk about profit? All I have is benevolence and righteousness. If you ask about profit for your kingdom, then your ministers are going to ask about profit for their families. And commoners are going to ask about profit for themselves. I mean, everybody all down the line is going to follow your example and say, so what's in it for me? In a kingdom with a 10,000 chariots, very large chariot, the king is going to be killed by a vassal who owns estates worth 1,000 chariots. And in a smaller state, a 1,000 chariot state, then the king's going to be killed by a vassal with 100 chariots. Even 100 chariots is a lot to have, but when profit is put before righteousness, no amount can satisfy, right? Even if you have 100, even if you have 1,000, you always want more. Now do you see, this is Mencius still speaking, now do you see why I teach benevolence and righteousness? Why bother to mention profit? Sima Qian, the great historian about 100 BC, I talk about him in a lot of lectures, I'll have a whole lecture about him later on, he writes a biography of Mencius. He actually writes biographies of most of these early thinkers. And then he has a personal reaction, response at the end of that chapter. And he says, whenever I read the book of Mencius and I come to the passage where King Wei of Liang asks, how can I profit my kingdom? I cannot help but set my book aside and sigh, saying, alas, desire for profit is surely the beginning of ruin. Okay, I always like that image because Sima Qian hasn't read more than the first page of Mencius before he sets it aside with a sigh. Alas, profit's going to be the ruin of everything. It's self-interest, let's say. It's going to be the ruin of everything. Okay, we're now going to move to the second great mind in this lecture, and this is Xunzi. Xunzi lives from about 300 to 210 BC, so he belongs in the next generation of Confucians after Mencius. In contrast to Mencius, Xunzi was a prominent, respected political advisor whose writings are essays rather than records of conversations. He was a major figure in the Jixia Academy in the state of Qi, a fairly prominent state, and he lived to see most of China conquered by the rising state of Qin. That's Q-I-N. That's an important name. We're going to pick up that story in the next lecture. Xunzi believed that direct observation and the record of human history left no doubt that human nature is evil. Okay, maybe not quite evil. I mean, not in the sense of cruel and depraved, but certainly selfish, self-interested. Nevertheless, he says, enlightened self-interest can motivate people to choose virtue and cooperation. So, a follower of Mencius might say, well, if people want to do what's right, where does that desire come from? Maybe that's innate. And Xunzi says, no, everybody wants what they don't have. So just as the poor want to be rich, people who are evil by nature desire goodness. Goodness is not natural, but it's the result of conscious effort. So morality doesn't come from innate impulses. It has to be learned. And that's why education is the key, right? So on this point, Mencius and Xunzi are going to be in perfect agreement. This is why they're both Confucians, is they both care about education. For Mencius, you're innately good, but those impulses have to be nurtured and paid attention. Education is important for that. For Xunzi, you are bad at the core, but that can be changed and improved through education. Xunzi's analogy is that people are like warped wood. Warped wood can be made straight by the application of steam and a straightening board and pressure. So what's needed are teachers and rituals, right? This is Li, ceremony, that bring out the positive aspects of people, and also laws to deter negative behaviors. The rules of conduct are an important part of ethics, but morality is, in the end, according to Xunzi, a human construct rather than an inheritance from heaven. The sages, in ancient times, came up with the rules of ritual themselves. I mean, they work, they're valuable, but they're not the product of revelation. They don't come from God or from heaven. Xunzi actually takes a rather secular approach to life. He says heaven is just nature. Okay, the Chinese word tian literally means sky. Okay, it's just the sky. It functions in a mechanical fashion with no concern for human society or for human values. Natural disasters, he says, are not messages from the other side. They're not portents. They're not warnings, as in mandate of heaven theories. They're simply natural phenomena. And Xunzi kind of makes sense in an age of science. I mean, he would see eclipses and earthquakes as just being part of the way the world works. In his essay on heaven, so this is part of his book called the Xunzi, he makes the following sorts of observations. He says, heaven doesn't suspend winter just because people don't like the cold. Don't worry about eclipses or comets or trees that make strange sounds in the night. And, you know, people say, oh, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's just the transformations of yin and yang. And notice that even Confucians talk in terms of yin and yang by this point. This is after the 100 schools and things are getting mixed up and people are debating each other in the Tao Hotel. Rather than heavenly portents, it's human portents that matter. Okay. What are human portents? He says, when you're traveling around and you see fields that have been abandoned, that are untended, when there are high prices for basic commodities, when people are starving, when there are bodies on the roadside, then you know that things are going wrong. Those are human portents. I love what Xunzi says about natural disasters. He says, if the government is good, if the rulers are practicing the way, if they're looking after the people, even if there are floods and droughts, people won't go hungry. But if the government is corrupt and oppressive, even if there are no floods and droughts, people will still suffer and they'll still starve. I mean, ultimately, the worst disasters are man-made. It's how people react to what comes just mechanically by nature through natural processes. So rituals are important. Actually, they're crucial in fostering goodness. And they also provide psychological satisfaction, but they don't influence the workings of the cosmos. Xunzi notes that when people pray for rain, it rains sometimes. Why is that? And he says, well, actually, it'll always rain eventually, whether people pray or not. Rulers can participate in ceremonies and sacrifices, but whereas the people believe in them superstitiously, rulers know that the most important function of such rituals is to promote harmony and order. For example, sacrifices to the ancestors give expression to feelings of remembrance and longing for the dead. Expectations of supernatural intervention by departed loved ones are rather beside the point. It's like I have a friend who's an atheist who believes in the power of prayer. And I remember asking him, saying, you don't even believe there's a God. Like, why do you pray? That doesn't make any sense. And he said, well, actually, there's something about prayer where you sit in a calm place, you focus on particular things, and when you do that, that sort of concentration sometimes leads to ideas that you haven't had before. So I think you can get answers to prayer, even though I don't think they come from God at all. Okay, compare that to Xunzi talking about the rituals. He says, the gentlemen understand them as the human way. The common people think of them as matters having to do with spirits. Let me talk for just a minute about ancestor worship. When your parents die, you're still connected to them. You still have the same relationship. But it's not like they've gone into a completely transcendent realm. It's more like they've moved away, far away, let's say to Indonesia. They're never coming back. You're not going to see them again. But you can still send care packages. You can send letters. This is prayers and ceremonies and sacrifices you can make actually to feed the ancestors who might be hungry on the other side. And in return, they might pull some strings on your behalf and help you out, sort of the way they did when they were alive, to make your life better in some ways. Now, you worship 3 degrees of ancestors. So your parents, actually, this is all on your father's side. So it has to be your parents, and then your father's parents, your paternal grandparents, and then paternal great-grandparents. And just 3 levels of ancestor worship for ordinary sorts of people. When Christian missionaries, Jesuits, came into China originally, they looked at what was going on with ancestor worship, and they said, what are we going to do about this? Is it idolatry or not? And the Jesuits said, it's actually just respect. It's a very high degree of respect, but it's just honoring your father and your mother. Later on, there were Dominicans who came in who said, no, this is idolatry. I mean, if we're not going to put up with Protestant Christianity, why should we put up with Confucian Christianity? The issue got debated back in Rome. The Pope came down on the side of the Dominicans and said, ancestor worship is inappropriate for Chinese Christians, which actually is going to pretty much end Christianity in China. It just pulls people too far out of civilized society, the way that the Chinese had defined it. Eventually, the emperor himself sided with the Jesuits and said, I'm not going to accept any Dominicans, and who is this guy in Italy who's telling my people what they can and can't believe? And Christianity just sort of falters in China over the issue of ancestor worship. Okay, back to Mencius early on. If Mencius gets credit for early economic thinking, we can recognize Xunzi as one of the first environmentalist philosophers. He urges rulers to adopt laws that conserve grasses and trees, fish and turtles, so that they can remain abundant. For example, he suggests that mountain forests should not be cut down when they're flowering or putting forth new shoots. And he wants nets and poisons prohibited from marshes during times when fish and turtles are depositing their eggs. He says, so as not to cut short their life and not to break their growth. And finally, language is also a rather arbitrary human construct, according to Xunzi. So words should be used precisely. And Xunzi talks about the rectification of names, which is basically matching names to reality, particularly in government offices, where you want to make sure that the person doing the office has the right title and the right description of what his responsibilities are. Xunzi's philosophy is very carefully articulated, and it's very readable. Okay, where does all of this go from here? Mencius and Xunzi, as followers of Confucius, have been compared to Plato and Aristotle, who were followers of Socrates. I mean, they have a lot in common. Both of these thinkers like education. They think that people can become sages. They like moral government and ritual. But Mencius tends to be more idealistic and Xunzi more maybe more realistic, sort of like Plato is oftentimes thought of as more idealistic and Aristotle more down-to-earth. Xunzi's unsentimental realism was probably a better fit for the Warring States era, right, a time of great violence and chaos. And he was probably more influential in early China. Yet Mencius's ideas eventually overshadowed those of Xunzi. Why is that? It may be that Chinese culture is basically optimistic. They like the idea that people are naturally good. Xunzi was more open to the role of laws in statecraft, and some of his students were associated with legalism, which we'll talk about in the next lecture. And consequently, Xunzi's reputation suffered when the legalist Qing dynasty was taken over and repudiated by its successor, the Han dynasty. People blame all those bad things on legalists. In the 12th century, the writings of Mencius, actually the Book of Mencius, is going to be included in the 4 books, along with the Analects and then 2 chapters from the Book of Rites. This collection became the fundamental text of Neo-Confucianism. We'll see that in Lecture 23. And those 4 books will be the subject matter for the Imperial Civil Service exams for about 700 years. The prominence of Mencius in Chinese thought is the reason why he and Confucius are the only 2 Chinese philosophers who are known in English by Latinized names. because they were first introduced to the West by Jesuit missionaries writing in Latin in the 17th century. So Confucius, that I-U-S, and Mencius, I-U-S. In Chinese, it's Kongzi. There's that zi that means master, and Mengzi. In popular culture, Chinese is a challenging language, and so you have to learn a lot of words, but also some four-character phrases, some slogans. And Chinese always are putting these little phrases into their discussion. The closest thing I can think of in English is maybe something like monkey see, monkey do, which would be hard to understand if you weren't a native English speaker, but you know, if you have heard that phrase, you know what it means. Mencius writes fairly clear, straightforward Chinese. It's a good place to start learning classical Chinese, and he includes some memorable stories and illustrations. For example, a man from the state of Song was impatient for seedlings to grow, and he went out and pulled them up a bit to help them out. Went home, his sons, and he said, "I'm tired, I'm just exhausted." His son said, "What have you been doing?" He said, "I've been helping seedlings to grow." Okay. His son went out to the field to see what was going on, and already everything had started withering. Mencius says you can't force self-cultivation. And there's this four-character phrase, ba miao zhu jiang, that means pulling at the sprouts to help them grow. Okay. People hear that and they know, oh yeah, that means you can't rush a natural process, otherwise you'll ruin things in the attempt. Okay, two more, very quickly, that you've already heard about. For hopeless, wrong-headed actions, somebody Chinese may say, yuan mu chou yu, it's like climbing a tree to look for a fish. Remember the king that Mencius was talking to who tried to gain the empire by violence. And finally, in China, a wise mother is devoted to her children's education, and that sort of thing might elicit the comment, meng mu san qian. Mencius' mother moved three times. Okay. What a lovely example of how mothers sometimes can cultivate and nurture their children and set an example. And perhaps that's a good place to end here with the question, what are you willing to do for your children?